Are you ready for a whole new way of being in the world? Welcome to Living from the Inside Out with Michael Neal.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you may be. Our topic for today is experiencing God, and my very special guest is Anita Morjani. We will take your calls, I think, later in the show. But if you want to get in and have a chance to talk to Anita and I about, oh, I don't know, experiencing God and related topics, the numbers to call, 866-254-1579, toll-free in the United States and Canada, 866-254-1579. Outside the United States and Canada, 001-760-918-4300. And on the very off chance that you have not heard of Anita Morjani, she's an international speaker. She is the author of the New York Times bestseller, Dying to Be Me, and What If This Is Heaven? And what's the new book called, Anita? It's not out yet.
It's not out yet. It's called Sensitive is the New Strong.
Sensitive is the New... Oh, I want to get that as a t-shirt. I'm going to read a little bit from your bio, Anita, just for do the official thing, and I'll do the unofficial thing. After a four-year battle with cancer, Anita fell into a coma and was given days to live. As her doctors gathered to revive her, she journeyed into a near-death experience where she was given the choice to return to her physical form or to continue into this new realm. She chose the former, and when she regained consciousness, her cancer began to heal. To the amazement of her doctors, she was free of countless tumors and cancer indicators within weeks. Now, it sounds strange, but that's not why we're here. Because why we're here, why I've asked Anita to join me, and why Anita and I spend time together talking about experiencing God is there was something that, and forgive me, Anita, for talking about you like you're not here for about one more minute, and then I'm going to stop pretending you're not here. The course of experiencing what she experienced it on the other side of the veil, as she puts it, one of the things that Anita saw was that God was not a separate being, but a state of being, and that heaven was not a destination, but a state of mind. And that so meshed with everything I've seen in my exploration of the inside out understanding over the last decade and everything that I talk about on the show, that it just seemed like if you'll forgive the phrase, a marriage made in heaven for the two of us to be talking about this. So Anita, very long intro. Welcome.
Thank you. That was, I'm honored at the intro. So thank you for that. And, it's just fun to be here. And the reason I'm here is because I always enjoy talking to you and I have so much fun.
Well, there you go. That works out well then. So I thought probably the best way for us to begin would be to talk a little bit about, in your words, what you saw that made sense of the word God to you.
Okay.
Or made a new sense of it.
Okay. So yes, what made a new sense? So before I had this near-death experience, before I felt my... we can call it soul, essence, spirit, whatever you want to call it, before I felt it actually leaving my body and leaving this whole world behind. So before that whole experience, I used to believe that God is a separate entity from us. I used to believe that, you know, it's almost like somebody whose approval that I needed in this world. I needed to be a certain way to get his approval. I needed to beg and plead him if I wanted stuff. I needed to try and figure out, why was he punishing me? What have I done? And I think a lot of people probably relate to this, because this is probably how we see God and religion, or at least how we did a few decades ago. So I grew up with that belief that God was somebody who I had to constantly work at winning his approval to get favors. And I used to be fearful of God. I used to be fearful of death. I used to be fearful of the afterlife. And also, to make things a little bit more complicated, my parents are Hindus. So I had this fear of karma, because I learned about karma. So I believed that whatever I do wrong, I'm going to get karmic retribution in the afterlife. So I grew up with all these fears. And when I had this experience, when I left my physical body, I realized that when I left my physical body, I also left behind, you know, not only the body, but also the gender, the culture, the beliefs, the religion. Everything was left behind. In other words, death transcends everything, including religion, including our beliefs about religion. And so that just blew me. And I would say blew my mind, but I was actually out of my mind, because the mind is part of your physical body. So at that point, I was even out of my mind. So it just blew open the way that I view life and the world. And it changed me. It changed me completely, because it was in that state that I realized that the homeless guy on the street, the cashier, the person at the checkout in the grocery store, each and every one of us is an expression of God. Each and every one of us. In other words, there's nobody whose approval that I need to seek. I am expressing God. I already am expressing God. And that changed my entire perspective of how I lived my life. And I suddenly realized that I had spent a lifetime seeking approval of everybody around me. You know, my dad when I was younger, and he was a tough one, and teachers, bosses, like I always needed other people's approval. But when you suddenly realize, no, there's nobody's approval you need. You are here as an expression of God, to be a facet of God. And so you are here godding, as you and I said. We're kind of here saying, all right, how does God react here? How does God do this? How does God want to experience this? So all of us are part of, or facets of God, experiencing different facets of life. And I realized, oh my gosh, so all this time when I was begging, pleading, I didn't have anyone to beg and plead to. It was to me. It's like, okay, I'm going through this bad experience. No one has done it to me, but God has decided to experience this at this point in time. So it just completely changed my perspective.
Well, and one of the things that, you know, it's probably a very common metaphor for it, but it speaks directly to the experience you had, is it's how a wave would make sense of the ocean, or maybe more particularly how a drop of water would try to make sense of the ocean, right? It would probably, you know, I don't know if drops of water live in communities, but let's say they do. Let's say they live in communities called waves, right? And they have, you know, the prestige, you know, I live near the crest of the wave, actually. Oh, really? Yeah, no, I still live down in the bottom of the wave with all the other little drops of water. And they have their conflicts because, you know, drops of water that reflect the light are better than drops of water that don't. And drops of water closer to the fish are better than drops of water that, you know, and so they have all their disputes. And they all worship this thing called the ocean. But some of them say the ocean is a mean and vengeful ocean. And others say, no, the ocean is a kind and loving ocean.
Yeah.
Regardless of any of the conversation or which side different drops of water line up on, the ocean is the constant. And they could no more be separate from it, no matter what they believe, no matter what they think, then we can be separate from God, no matter what we believe, no matter what we think.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. And that is so true. And if we were to extrapolate from that, and let's say, because what was coming to my mind is, imagine that when the ocean creates a wave and all these droplets of water, you know, like there's like this spray, because the wave gives off a spray. And the spray is all these tiny, tiny, tiny little droplets of water. And imagine if each of those tiny droplets of water identified themselves as individual droplets, and they saw all the other droplets as being separate, and they were all praying to this ocean to say, oh my God, the ocean, it's a vengeful ocean, it's a scary ocean. And they're praying that the ocean won't punish them. But eventually all those droplets fall back into the ocean and realize, oh, we are the water, we are the ocean, we always were. We just got separated for a little bit, but we are still made of the same substance, the same quality. We are no different.
Now, so I'm gonna do two things. Let me do a quick plug. For those of you who don't know, Anita and I have a new program which just came out this month called Experiencing God, an online program, and you can find out more about that at michaelneal.org/experiencinggod. And we're also going to be getting together live in LA September 15th and 16th. And you can learn about that at michaelneal.org/experiencinggodlive. To take it a step further, why, to your mind, why experiencing? Like, why is experiencing it as opposed to just kind of going, agreeing with, like, I agree. Yes, we are part of God. Okay, what's for dinner? Like, why, what is it about experiencing it that is important?
When you just agree, you're coming from the mind. You're not actually feeling it. And there's a difference between coming from the mind and, I guess, coming from the heart or coming from the self. When you actually feel it, that's where transformation begins. And transformation begins when the mind gets out of the way. Whereas things like agreeing, believing, reading, learning, that's still, you're still in the mind. And actually, you need to get the mind out of the way to feel it. And that's kind of what we have been trying to create with these seminars and with the videos that we've been doing, is we're trying to create, and words are, it's not always easy using words to get people to experience or to feel something, but very often those are the best tools we have at hand. I mean, I also sometimes use music and meditation, but the idea is not just about it having, not just about it being a mental exercise or mental gymnastics, but to really feel it at your core so that you start to react to life from a different place, just from a different place. It changes who you are at your very core. It changes your being.
Well, that's what it seems like to me. It seems to me that it's almost like if there was an elevator of, and I sometimes use the metaphor of a glass elevator of consciousness. And so, you know, sort of if you're on the ground floor, all you see is whatever's down there. As you get higher and higher, you see more and more. You have more perspective on the world. You have more perspective on life. Things that seem like a big deal down on the ground floor, as you get higher up, don't, you can see the larger pattern. What makes the elevator go up is experiencing ourselves in this way.
Yeah.
It is those moments where we are able to rest in the moment, those moments where we are able to be filled up by our own aliveness, by our own God nature, by our own spirit, when we are inspired. That raises the elevator. So it's not just, it feels great. Like, if it was just that it feels great, that would still be cool, because it does.
Yeah.
But don't order yet, kids, because it not only is an amazing feeling, that feeling of interconnectivity, that feeling of oneness, the feeling, the weirdest way that I have of describing it, because it's also the most accurate, is when I am in that space and there's traffic, it's like the cars are driving through me.
Wow.
Instead of near me.
I love that.
In and of itself, really cool, cheaper than drugs, more readily available, less taxed. But the fact that it also does something for us, it does something to us in a way I sometimes think of it like a hyperbaric chamber where, you know, the oxygen rich tents where that athletes use for healing and recovery and to build stamina, where you're just infused with spirit, you're infused with God energy, you're infused with aliveness. And that infusion means that even in those moments where you're not in the tent, where you're not in the experience, everything works better. Everything works more as designed. Everything is sort of optimized.
That is so true and so beautifully said. So beautifully said. An analogy that I often use in with my audience and in my workshops is I actually ask them to imagine if they have been blind their whole life, you know, that they were born blind and they've never had sight. And if you've never had sight, there's no way for you to understand what colors, you know, how do you even define different colors? How do you tell someone this wall is green and this one's red? A wall is a wall. And also, there's no way to define to people things like the height of a building. I mean, can a blind person who cannot see a building from the outside and cannot see that a building has 12 stories, do they understand what's happening when they step in an elevator and they press buttons and then they go into this elevator and then they come out at another level? Are they actually comprehending what they're doing, that they're going up the different levels? Or do they have to take stairs to really understand that, okay, I am going to where I need to be? And I often wonder about these things, that if you're born blind, how much of this world do you really understand? And you can't gauge distances the way we do. We just take it for granted. You can look at a wall and you can say, that's 40 feet away or 30 feet away, and I can fit this much furniture. A blind person can't do that. They physically have to walk the steps to measure where everything is. So now imagine, though, if the blind person one day had sight, and even if they had sight for just one day, their whole perception of the world would change. It would just completely change, where it's like, oh my God, everything makes sense. Now I know why I bump into that. Now I know what people mean by the different colors of walls. Now I know what it means when people say the sky is blue, or what it means for something to be up, and heights of buildings, and what's happening when I get in an elevator. And suddenly the whole world makes sense. Now, even if they were to go back to being blind again, their experience of the world is very, very different. So if the person was blind and never had sight, when somebody who's sighted is explaining things to them, they're trying to understand, but it's coming from a mental place. They're just trying to understand. And a lot of their understanding is based on faith. It's like, okay, I have to believe you. I have to trust you. I have to trust you that there's a hole there. I shouldn't go that way. I have to trust you. But when you have sight, even if it's for a day, then it's a full immersion of understanding and clarity. It's like, oh, I get it now. I get what I was doing when I was going in the elevator and what the button does when I press it. It's like this full clarity. And that's kind of what I do with people when I'm with them or when I speak to them. And this is one of the reasons I enjoyed doing the events with you, Michael, is because together we were able to get people into that state where it's no longer just a mental exercise, but it's like an immersion. It's like, oh, I get it. I get it. And that's really the idea behind it.
And to take, I'm going to slightly bastardize your metaphor, but if we say that the blindness is because we're in a pitch black room.
Yeah.
And I know you have a similar metaphor around a warehouse, but just that we either try to get better and better at navigating in the dark, which is what so much of what we do try to do, is we try to learn strategies for this and strategies for that. And we study, well, they seem to know what they're doing. Let me follow them.
Yes.
And that's a completely different notion than learning to live in the light.
Yes.
Then learning to a certain extent where the light switch is. Now, it's not a switch in my experience, as in you can snap your fingers and voila, you know, there's God. Well, I mean, it's more, the more we see that all that happens is we're in the dark or we're in the light.
Yeah.
Then the less we worry about it when we're in the dark, and the less we're inclined to try and take on the world when we're in the dark. And the more appreciative, the more grateful, the more we just are ready to take on the world when the light dawns.
Yes. Yeah, I like that. And again, okay, so to bastardize
yeah,
re-bastardize
my bastardize. Yeah, come on, let's do this. There's going to be so many bastards at the end of this show, it's going to be ugly. All right.
This is kind of fun. This is like tennis, volleying it back and forth. So what I really like is that, so when all these people come up with strategies of that, okay, 10 ways, I mean, not to knock them down, I actually quite like it when people simplify it, you know, things for it. But what I'm talking about is when they say, okay, watch that person, learn from that person, let's do it this way, let's model that person. Just like what you said, we are actually teaching people how to navigate the dark, right? But when you switch on the light, we are actually showing people that you don't need those strategies. You don't need, because you are then, so you are then seeing everything so clearly that you won't need the strategies anymore. So what I'm trying to say is that when you teach someone how to navigate in the dark, they're still coming from the mind. But when you show somebody that they can switch on the light, and this is the thing I believe that every single person is able to switch on that light and to live in the light. Every single person can do it, but they just don't realize they can. They were never told it. Our conditioning, our education system, our medical system, all of these systems are systems that live in the dark and teach us how to navigate in the dark.
And if that were genuinely, if the choices were struggle in the dark or be guided in the dark, mm-hmm. Thank goodness. Like, how wonderful. But there's not even, it doesn't seem to me to be even taken seriously as a possibility by the culture, but even by most of us individually, that there's a realistic option that you could live your life lit up.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And it's what saddens me is that the people who actually have discovered that you can live in the light, quite often when they share the message or when they share how you can live in the light or how they've done it, they are usually, they're usually silenced by the ones who have a lot to gain by keeping people in the dark.
Well, and there's a fear thing too, because there's these weird experiments with monkeys. I don't know why monkeys are experiment, but where, when if you've got a bunch of monkeys in a cage, but the top is open so that they could get out, the monkeys in the cage will stop the monkey trying to get out. They'll grab onto the monkey and try and keep it in the cage.
I've heard of that with a different animal, a different species, with crabs.
Okay.
If you go catching crabs on the beach and you have a bucket and you throw the crabs into the bucket, even if you don't put a cover on the bucket, you know, the crabs will start to climb up the sides, but they will never get out because the ones below see the ones climbing up and they will try and follow by grabbing onto the one in front of them, but they'll end up pulling that one down. So each one is pulling the others down. So they never get out of the bucket, but they're all trying to get out of the bucket.
And we can hear that and we can kind of project our own situations onto it and go, yeah, I got a cousin like that, right? You know, but it's not malice.
It's not
actually
malice.
This
it's
desire
fear.
For safety. And it comes from fear.
Yes, it comes from fear and it's a desire for safety. It is, you know, like, for example, I had a somewhat traumatic childhood in that I feel that my dad, he just did not know how to show affection. He did not know how to show love. But I did some work, like in order to, I guess you could say, in order to overcome it and in order to forgive him and accept everything, I started to study his background, like what he had to go through. And when I saw what he had to go through, I understood why he turned out to be the way he was. And so my dad is deceased, and when I had this out-of-body experience when I was at end-stage cancer, this near-death experience, I encountered the essence of my dad, and all I felt from him was pure, unconditional love. There was, like, no judgment, no fear, nothing, nothing at all. And I realized it's because in that state, he was no longer a victim of his culture and his upbringing and all the adversity he had to go through. And so this is the thing. There is no malice. People are just being who they are by the weight that they carry on their shoulders. They carry their backgrounds with them. And we're expressing through that.
So if you want to learn more, if you want to be part of this conversation, you can join Anita and I live, depending on when you're listening to the show, of course, September 15th and 16th, 2018, in Los Angeles. You can learn more about that at michaelneal.org/experiencinggodlive. And at any time, you can join us for the online program, Experiencing God, michaelneal.org/experiencinggod. Would you be up for taking a question, Anita?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, let's go to New Jersey and let's speak with Elaine. Elaine, welcome to the show. What's your question?
I read your book and I found it fascinating. And I'd like to know, did you see a lot of deceased loved ones on the other side? And do they know what's going on in our lives?
Yes. Yes, on both counts. I saw a lot of deceased loved ones. I saw my dad. I saw my best friend. But there were other entities who I didn't recognize. But I knew they knew me. I didn't recognize them from this life, but I felt nothing but compassion and unconditional love from them, and they knew everything. It was like coming home. It was like feeling welcomed, and I just experienced this state of real clarity as to why I had been through everything I had been through, and I felt that everybody around me knew, and they were there to comfort me and take care of me. So it was just like the most beautiful feeling ever, more beautiful than anything I had experienced in this physical world up to that point. But I have to say that after that experience, I have been able to create many, many beautiful moments here, because the interesting thing is that experiencing death actually taught me how to live. It taught me how to create something quite beautiful here in this physical.
And when you came back, did you become psychic?
I will say yes, I did. But yet I'm always hesitant to say that, because I have this little bit of fear that suddenly there'll be all these people knocking on my door and asking me to do readings for them. I actually believe that we all have the ability to be psychic. We all do, but it gets conditioned out of us. So we are, every single one of us are actually six sensory beings. And we think that experiences like this, you know, like me having an NDE, wakes up our sixth sense and, you know, kicks it in. Actually, we're born six sensory beings, but our conditioning makes us forget the sixth sense. So an experience like this reminds me again that, yes, I have this sixth sense, and it makes me embrace it, and it makes me realize. So it's just like the blind person who goes from blind to being sighted. Now imagine when they become sighted. They realize, so they've gone from a four sensory being to five sensory. So I'm talking about us being five sensory going to six sensory. But imagine a blind person becoming sighted, and then that blind person having to live in a world where everybody else is blind. But actually, if they opened their eyes, they could see. But they've been conditioned that when they open their eyes, what they see is their imagination, and it's not true. So imagine if they've been conditioned and they've been told, no, you have to keep your eyes closed, because if you open your eyes, you're being a quack. It's not true. It's your imagination. That's what's happened to us. And okay. So we all have that ability to live as six sensory beings.
Thank you, Elaine.
I'm not through yet.
Okay. We'll give you one more.
Question,
how about
please?
That? We'll give you one more.
Okay. I have a neighbor who's very, very evil. And I don't think there's anybody in the world who has sustained that much damage to their property as I have. And I like to know why they're doing it. What is the reason? They want me to move? My sister thinks they want us to move so they could take the house for the door. They're destroying all our property. It's heartbreaking.
All right. So I'm gonna put Elaine on hold and take her off, because that is I actually would love us to talk about evil, but. As you just said, you one of the reasons you don't normally talk about being psychic is you don't want people calling in to ask you psychic questions. So could we broaden that out, though, And could we just take that as an exploration of what's your take on evil?
So my take on evil is that evil, what we have labeled as evil, it's like really easy to label people as evil, but what we have labeled as evil is actually, it actually stems from fear. And that's truly, that is what I really believe, that there are no evil people. They are just extremely fearful people. And they believe that other people are out to get them. And they're so fearful. And that's why they have to hold on or hoard. Or they have a belief that I live in a world where I either have to conquer or be conquered. I have to kill or be killed. And this is why they appear to be so destructive. But it comes from fear of trying to hold on to or self-preservation. And it comes from believing that they have to do this as a survival mechanism. There are very few people, very, very few, who actually have the psychological disposition of being a psychopath or a sociopath. And that is something clinically wrong with them. And if there's something clinically wrong, that means they're sick. So that doesn't make them evil either. They are just sick and they can't help themselves. So that's why I tend not to think of people as being evil. But yes, from a perspective, Elaine was not wrong in that that person was evil to her. Yes. But that person was acting out of their own fears. And it was, and it's not Elaine's fault. And there are ways she can mitigate that, which I can even throw out there for the audience.
Well, so let me again, just, I mean, by all means, but I do want to kind of go to the general rather than the specific, because I think often we get lost in, yeah, but my situation's different.
Mm.
And I think to the extent that we can see the universality in things, we find our own way. So it's again that thing of, I'm in the dark, but you see light, so could you tell me? Versus, hey, you know what? You've got a light switch too.
Exactly. And that's where I wanted to go.
Absolutely. So yeah. So here's the thing. From in physics, and this is how it was explained to me, so if this is incorrect, I apologize to physicists everywhere. But that black isn't a color.
Yeah, black, it's the absence of light.
It's what we call what it looks like when there is no color, when there is no light. And in the same way, it seems that what we call evil is a description of the absence of light. It's a description of the absence of love.
Yes, 100%. I'm with that's, and in the absence of love, in the absence of light, there is fear. And we label it as evil because we don't understand it, but also because we are feeling the repercussions of that person's fear. That person's fear is targeted at us. So let's say that person's fear is targeted at me. I will say, oh my God, that person is really evil. So I don't even want to judge the people who label people as evil because they are feeling the repercussions and the pain from it. So Elaine, I don't want to judge her for calling her neighbor evil, but at the same time, her neighbor is acting from a place of total and pure fear. And what her neighbor is doing feels to her like a survival mechanism.
You know, we take one of the videos in the Experiencing God program, you and I talked about this notion of forgiveness as being seeing the innocence.
Mm-hmm.
That rather than an act where you take, well, they're evil, but I'll forgive them anyways, that when you can see that people can't do other than what seems right to them to do.
Yeah.
And in those moments, and boy, howdy, am I not like a walking encyclopedia of how to do this. But when I do see it, when I see that there is, you can't do other than you see. If it looks to you like someone is attacking you, you will either defend or hide or attack back.
Yeah.
That's it. If it looks to you, if it really looks to you like a situation is safe, you'll just relax. You won't have to remind yourself. If it looks to you like the world is against you, you will either give up or fight against the world. If it looks to you like the world is uplifting you. And so what becomes important to my mind is not trying to get more positive beliefs, but to see what we can see about what's true. What would be true regardless of what we think? And that's why I always take us back to principles, to gravity, to electricity, that works the same whether we're theoretically evil or theoretically wonderful, right? Mirrors reflect the Dalai Lama and whoever you think the most evil person going right now is the same.
Yes, 100%. And so, but going back to, for example, let's say if you have someone who is fearful, someone who is really fearful, and they are so fearful that they are acting in ways that are destructive for them and other people, and nothing you say to them is going to climb, is going to help them out of that. What I often believe is that because we are all connected, even that person who is fearful, even that person who's acting out in these ways, just like you said, they are reflecting the same as me. That person is a facet of the same God that I am. So the way, the best way that I can help that person is by seeing that. It's by seeing exactly that, that that person is a facet of the same God. And if I am now fearful of that person, I am feeding them the fear. I'm actually making it worse. It's like fighting fire with fire. So my job, if I want to, if I want to actually pour water on the situation, if I want to cool the situation down, if I want to heal the situation, then what I actually have to do is send them love. And if, and this is the part that many people find hard to do, because when somebody is horrible to you, when we say that person is evil, when we're not willing to see, okay, they're coming from fear, they're coming from their beliefs, and they are in survival mode. If we can't see that, if we say that person is evil and they're out to get me, so I have to protect myself by taking revenge, what we're actually doing is we are fighting fire with fire. But when we can see that, okay, that person's actions is coming from fear, they feel unsafe, they feel they have to do this as a survival mechanism, let me respond with love. Let me, even if I can't be near them because I want to be safe, I want to protect myself, I am going to send them love remotely. Because remember, I said to you that all of us have been conditioned that our eyes are closed and we cannot open them, that we are blind and we cannot see. What I mean by that is we have been conditioned that we are five sensory beings, but in actually we are six sensory beings, and people can feel what you feel. But you have not, you know, we, and this is what I mean by when I said, I am psychic, but so are you. And so even for Elaine, you are psychic. You can send that person loving thoughts. You can think of them in a way of love. You can forgive them internally. You can actually visualize them surrounded by love, and their attitude towards you will change. They will soften. And I guarantee you that this actually works. It works because we are connected. We are six sensory beings. And the reason we don't always realize it works is because our instinct is to react also from a place of fear, which means we're fighting fire with fire, which is only growing it.
So one of the things that I think actually we both talked about it in different ways in the program was the word namaste.
Yeah.
And I gave the long form, which is I honor the place in you in which the entire universe resides. I honor the place in you of love, of light, of truth, and of peace. And when you are in that place in you, and I am in that place in me, there is only one of us. Now, as I remember, your definition was much shorter than that. and what was it? I honor the God in you. I see God in you. It was something of that ilk.
Yes, it is. I mean, basically, to me, namaste is I see you and I as one.
Right.
It really is, and that really would be my short version, is that you and I are one. What I do to you, I do to me. And it is, I honor the God in you.
And so for me, when I listen to the conversation we've been having and this idea of 5 cents, 6 cents, it strikes me that there's almost, there's something in my mind, it's almost, it's quite funny, the word nonsensory. It's that when I see the divine in you, and I am coming from the divine in me, there is no one to forgive.
Yes.
There is no one to love. There is no one, because simply being who we are is the healing.
That's spot on. And that is what being one means. And many people, you've got it spot on, like really spot on. That is what it means to say we are one. It means there is nothing to forgive, because I see the God in you, you see the God in me, there is nothing to forgive.
Now, I know from experience and working with thousands of people over the years that if somebody tries to take that on as, okay, I will try to see the God in my jerk of a sister, right? You can't really do it that way. But it's almost just opening up to it. That if we are open to seeing beyond the form, if we are open to seeing beyond the particular behavior or set of behaviors, if we are open to seeing even beyond the pain and the story that creates the pain, to the very heart, the very soul, the very essence, then we see God. Well, us first.
Yes.
That when we can do that with ourselves, when we can see past the form, past the diagnosis, past the story, past the pain, past all of that, past even the great things that you may be doing and have done in the world.
Yes.
To that very source, that very essence. That is the experience of God. That is the experience of self with a capital S.
Yes, exactly. And that's the key, is that here's the thing. When you ask someone to see God in their boss, who's a real jerk, or that, you know, somebody or their sister and whoever is the real jerk, when you ask them to do that, if that person is not ready, either they will say you're crazy, they'll get angry, or you have the other extreme, the other side, where, like, let's say you have a bullying boss and you tell this person you have to see the God in your boss. What ends up happening sometimes is that this person almost allows themselves to be abused by the boss or bullied by the boss, because they are forcing themselves to see the God in their boss. So what you just said is the key, is that to see it in yourself first. It's when you are able to really see it in yourself that I am a facet of God, and when you can see it in yourself that you are the same energy, the same substance of God, that you are not this physical body, when you can see beyond your story, when you can see your vulnerabilities as not being who you are, but you accept them, and you accept and you see through the illnesses, you see through everything. When you can see it in yourself, then it's almost automatic that you can see it in other people, and you don't, and when you can see it in yourself, you are better able to not put yourself in a position to be bullied or to be a doormat to other people. Does that make sense?
It makes total sense, because it's almost like, I remember somebody coming up to me at a seminar, and they heard it intellectually. And they said, so, and they were very upset, and they said, so you're telling me that if I, you know, came up here and started kicking you, while you were speaking, that you wouldn't need to forgive me, cause I'm just God, and, you know, or however it was that they said it. And I just looked at them and I just said, but why would I stand here and let you kick me? Right.
Yeah.
We have this idea that as we become more enlightened, we become stupider. Right, that somehow seeing more to the heart of things, being more connected with our spiritual nature will make us into patsies. And it's an odd idea, because there's no other arena where seeing something more honestly and more truthfully makes you anything but more powerful.
That is 100% true. And you know, this is exactly what I'm writing about. I'm writing my third book right now, and I'm writing exactly about that, about how a lot of people have misinterpreted some of the messages of spirituality, where you think in terms of seeing God in the other, of not needing to forgive. And we become real patsies when we don't honor that God within ourselves. It really starts with the self before you can see God in others.
Well, so tell me a little bit more about that. So what in the new book, because I haven't even seen it yet, probably because you haven't finished writing it yet.
I haven't finished. I'm only halfway, exactly halfway through.
All right, no pressure, but you know, my entire life is on hold. But you know, take your time, please. Go out and have a nice coffee and stuff.
I will.
We're just role-playing what it is to stand up to a bully. What have you seen in kind of really taking a fresh look at that about that distinction, about how when we see God in ourselves, when we see God in others, when we experience, because also I like experience a little more than see, even though there's an element of seeing, because it's more tangible somehow, that when we experience God in self, God in other, when we experience, in fact, that there is no other and no self.
Yes.
How does that balance work? Because on the one hand, clearly you do become more sensitive. On the other hand, clearly you become stronger.
Yes, you do. But sometimes we interpret, okay, so this could get more confusing if I don't backtrack a little bit.
Backtrack away.
Okay, so the book I'm currently writing, I have titled it Sensitive is the New Strong. And that's the title I've given it. And, you know, sometimes publishers come in and change it. But anyway, I like that title myself. And the reason, the inspiration behind this book is that I grew up as someone who was super sensitive, but I was led to believe that sensitivity is a weakness. And I was led to believe that in order to navigate this world, I had to grow a thicker skin and stronger boundaries, and I had to stop being so sensitive. Now, it was only when I died did I realize that actually the sensitivity and empathy and all these things are actually gifts. And they are something they are a good thing. They're not something that needs to be suppressed. Now, here's where, for me, so I believe that this world, this paradigm we live in, doesn't support sensitivity. It makes life really hard. We tend to actually champion people who have thicker skins, you know, and people who have stronger boundaries, and people who want to compete and finish first, and people who treat life like a zero-sum game, that there have to be losers in order for me to win. Our paradigm seems to champion people like that. And so so in this book, I actually make a case that we may be on the brink of our own extinction if we keep going this way. I mean, if you watch the news, it's pretty easy to see that we could be on the brink of our own extinction. And maybe we have to redefine what the word strength means, because we've come this far because of evolution and survival of the fittest. But what we have defined as the fittest up until now has been conquer or be conquered, you know, kill or be killed, eat or be eaten. But maybe we have to redefine that now if we want to take human evolution to the next level. And maybe we really now need to see sensitivity, compassion, empathy as strengths and not as weaknesses, which is what people who have those traits have been feeling until now.
Yeah, I come across it again and again, and we've talked about it a little before, but there's something that happens where people equate seeing what's behind, you know, the pain behind the behavior, seeing you know, understanding why somebody behaves the way they behave as letting it continue. And to me, there's something really just continually amazing at seeing that I can totally see somebody's innocence and put them in prison for a crime. I can see their psychological innocence.
I like that. That's exactly.
That doesn't mean that behaviorally they are.
Yes.
I can see their spiritual innocence, but it doesn't mean behaviorally that they are. And so we can hold ourselves and others accountable at the level of behavior.
Yes.
While fully seeing and accepting and embracing the innocence, and the difference simply being that the punishment is sort of for everyone's safety. It's not punitive.
Yes, and that is absolutely true. I can't even add anything to it, because I agree with you 100%, and that's what it is. That's what seeing God in everyone is. So where I was going with what we were saying earlier about how people think that it makes you, what I don't remember the words you use, it makes you a patsy. That's what you said. That if you are...
And in fairness, I don't really know what that is. That sounds like something from a 1940s radio show. But, you know, we'll go with it.
Yes, but it makes you dumber. It makes you stupider when you see others as God, or when you see the God in everyone else. So in actuality, it doesn't. But people actually... So in the traditional way, when I used to learn that it was more spiritual to... turn the other cheek, to love people even if they were evil, what happened is that it turned me into a doormat. It turned me into a doormat. So I continued to allow bullies to continue to bully me because I felt I had to turn the other cheek. And this is why I say you need to see God within yourself. You need to experience God within yourself. Because why would God allow that? Even though I see the God in the bully, I too am God. Why would I allow God to be bullied? And I am God.
And well, it's almost like that if you see a small child and they're lashing out, and you're not threatened by them because they're a little kid, right?
You
know, they're really little, right? Then there's a sort of a, of course you don't let them break things, and you don't let them be destructive, and you don't let them hurt anyone.
Yes.
But there's no less love. If anything, there's an extra bounce of compassion in the love, like a shot of liquor in the coffee. It's like it's you feel even more for them.
Yes, that's it.
While doing absolutely everything that needs to be done to keep yourself and them safe.
Yes, but if you don't get it, if you are not experiencing God within yourself, but you are learning spiritual teachings purely from a intellectual perspective, then it doesn't work. That's my point. Because when you are learning things like see the God in them, they are God too, they are a mirror of you, what ends up happening is that you end up allowing yourself to become the patsy. I'm saying this from experience, because this is who I was before I had that experience of God when I died of cancer.
Unfortunately, we're coming to the end of our time, so let me just remind people, if you want to come and see Anita and I live in Los Angeles, September 15th and 16th, you can go to michaelneal.org/experiencinggodlive. If you want to do our online program, and it's discounted by $100 for the next 8 days, I think, then go to michaelneal.org/experiencinggod. And all this and more. I guess my final, my sort of unfair 30-second question is is, what if you had to put the experience of God for you into a word or a phrase? What would the word or phrase be?
Wow, that's oh my gosh! If I had to put it into a word, I would say that I would want everyone to know that you are God. You are enough. You are everything that you are trying to attain.
I think that works rather well. Madam, a pleasure as always.
Pleasure was mine. That was so much fun.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for listening. If you want to learn more about Anita, go to anitamorjani.com. If you want to join us for the programs, I gave the links many, many times. Until next time, have fun, learn heaps, and I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye for now.